Host, and welcome again to the Ask Beatty Show. And I think that we all need as much help as we can possibly get to really get our feet back on the ground. Although today I was reading in the news that restrictions are now going to be lifted. But when you think about the last couple of months, who would have ever dreamed that we would be dealing with masks? Should we wear them? Should we not wear them? Gloves, social distance, unemployment. Am I going to be able to pay my rent? Is my business going to close? What's going to happen to my employees? Physical isolation, actually too much closeness, boundary issues in families, and the list goes on and on. Homeschooling, parents who had jobs and who may not be able to really work from home, children who are no longer able to go to school. It's been a real upheaval for all of us around the world. And yet, you know, I always try to take a look at lessons to be learned. Is there something to possibly be gained by what's going on? And I think for all of us, for everybody that I've been talking to, friends and patients, it's been a time to really reevaluate our lives, and for many, many, many people to reset. I know I've been talking to a lot of people who are actually thinking of leaving New York City, people who are in New York and who've always lived in New York, and questioning, is there not a better way to live? Are there not better places where we can live when we're not in the midst these days of the coronavirus? So there's a lot of things, a lot of questions people are asking themselves over and above the usual issues of relationships and depression and anxiety and racism and politics and healthcare. And I'm sure that we're all going to come out of this with a different kind of a mindset, hopefully a better kind of a mindset than before this crisis. And what I have been encouraging everybody to do, including myself, is to find people that we can actually talk to, and some people want to reach out to support groups where we can really feel comfortable to honestly express all of our feelings of anxiety and worry and depression and sadness and anger, and to not self-isolate socially is something that is really, really important. And having that extra help, that extra person who you can really emote to, whether or not we're in the middle of a crisis or not, really does make all the difference in the world. And what I've really tried to do is to create a daily routine to help normalize my life. And I'm wondering whether you're doing the same thing. For example, every single morning I get up, I have my coffee, I do my exercises, I lift my weights, believe it or not, I do my makeup, I have my breakfast, and then of course I'm seeing all of my patients on Zoom and on Skype and on the telephone. And I'm trying also, I'm hoping that you two are as well, to be eating well and to be getting enough sleep and to be exercising. And I think what we've all learned, that we don't have to go to a gym in order to really stay in shape. And even just taking a walk around the block, and of course here in New York City, everybody is, at least in our area on the Upper West Side, people are wearing masks and gloves, and they are maintaining social distance. And yesterday I took a long, long walk with Cha-Cha, and it was just so nice to be out in the park, and people were actually respecting and maintaining the various different kinds of restrictions, so that we don't need to just stay in our apartments or stay in our houses, but we do need to be smart, and we do really need to do what is in our best interest. So hopefully you are exercising and eating well and trying to get enough sleep, and that you are not glued to the television set. I think that it's important we can get a couple of daily updates about what is going on, but gluing yourself to the television set or the computer 24 hours a day, it really is anxiety provoking, and it's not helpful. You're going to be able to find out at 5 o'clock probably similar kind of information that you would have found out at 8 or 9 o'clock in the morning. And I know that a lot of people that I know professionally and also socially are finding meditation to be very, very soothing, listening to music, dancing. And if you're finding that none of this is working for you, then I guess you'll have to dig in deeper and figure out what is it that you need to do actually that is going to be in your best interest. And so many people are saying, you know, every day, is it Thursday? Is it Friday? Is it Monday? One day kind of feels like the other. And yet slowly, slowly, we are going to be coming out of this. And it's going to be very interesting to see what the new normal is going to be. What we've been finding with mental health helplines is that people are actually using them. And that is a really, really positive, positive thing. I mean, 52% of those who are now working remotely are feeling more anxious working from home. Although what I'm finding, I'm kind of getting used to it. And it's not as anxiety provoking as it was a couple of months ago. I think that we're getting used to living in a very different kind of a way. And even when the restrictions are no longer there, I still think that our lives and our relationships are going to be different and different for different people in different ways. And it could be actually a very, very positive thing. Something that I've been very concerned about in reading is that alcohol sales have jumped 75%. Wine is up 66%. Beer, 42%. Cannabis actually reached an all-time high in March, even though medical experts are warning us that marijuana and vaping and tobacco may actually increase the risk of the virus. People are exercising less and eating more, although the weather now is beautiful, so hopefully we're going to be eating less and exercising more. And if you find yourself that you're judging your emotions or responses, please remind yourself that your feelings are normal and are justified. And when you're feeling overwhelmed, focus on breathing instead of reaching for your phone and the computer. And again, remember to set a news and social media cut off time so that you are not going to be continually concerned and worried about what it is going on. And I think that's one of the things too. I mean, there are certain things that we absolutely have no control over at all. And yet there are many, many things that we do, and we do need to recognize the difference. And the things that we do have control over, when we're going to sleep, how much television we're going to watch, how much we're going to eat, how much we're going to exercise, these are things that we can take control over, because we really do need to be mindful, and not just during this crisis time, of really doing things that are in our best interest. And in fact, that is the homework assignment that I give all of my patients after every single session as they are getting ready to leave. Of course, these days, as they are getting ready to leave, the Zoom or the Skype or the telephone therapies, I want people to be mindful as they are navigating their days, they're navigating their evenings, to be aware of doing things that are in their best interest. And I think it's important to just stop and ask yourself whether you're going to have that second or third glass of wine. Is this something that's really good for me, and to be aware of what is something that is destructive and self-destructive, so that you were then hopefully able to make a shift and to reset. Well, today I have a really, really wonderful guest who I've had on the show before. And his name is Chaim Steinberger. Chaim is a New York divorce attorney, divorce attorney. He clerked for the United States Court Judge and was recruited by some of the largest, most prestigious law firms in the country. And interestingly, during this time, he went through his own nasty divorce and said to himself, there's got to be a better way, right? Lessons to be learned. And he now dedicates his life to practicing that better way, bringing large firm professionalism, practice, and polish to the area of matrimonial and family law. Mr. Steinberger continues to study litigation, negotiation, and mediation so as to employ the latest and best techniques in each of these and other areas for the benefit of his clients. He serves as an arbitrator, judging disputes in small claims courts and other venues, and there and through his services as a law clerk and mediator, he sits in the middle of others' disputes and gets to feel what arguments are persuasive and compelling and which fall flat, making him a better advocate, litigator, and negotiator. So welcome, welcome, Chaim Steinberger.
Same here. It is my pleasure to join you, particularly
I wanted you to come back. I wanted you to come back because your first appearance on the Ask Beattie show, you know, it really moved me what a mensch you were. And I think that these days when people think about divorce, and divorce attorneys, there's often such a negative connotation that people really feel. So I wanted you to come back. And of course, today we're going to be talking about the perils of prenups. And I was always someone who thought that it was a really, really good thing and an important thing to have prenups. And yet you have found that a prenup agreement creates significant risk to pending nuptials, and for many provides no real benefit, while simultaneously creating substantial risk. So let's hear why you feel this way and what your findings have been when it comes to prenups.
So fundamentally, in New York State, now, of course, this may be different in different states, and we can talk about that some more, but in New York State, anything I own the day before I get married is my separate property. Anything my spouse owns the day before we get married is his or her separate property. And anything we earn or accumulate during the marriage belongs to the both of us and is deemed marital property, and of course, at the time of divorce in New York State, a court can divvy up the marital property, and we use a process that we call equitable distribution. Equitable doesn't mean equal, but it comes in a long-term marriage, it's generally equal. And so the marital property gets divvied up at divorce, but my separate property stays mine. My spouse's separate property belongs to my spouse, or at that point, ex-spouse. And so the real question is, when somebody asks their betrothed, I'd like for you to sign this prenup, what part of that equation are you looking to change? Whatever's mine before marriage is mine. Whatever's yours is yours. Whatever we earn during the marriage belongs to the both of us. What part of that do you want to change? And how do you justify a change to that without sounding like a jerk?
Well, but it sounds like in New York State, then, that there would not be a need for a prenup. Now, again, we don't know perhaps about what's going on in other states, but if that's all true, then the discussion is really a non-discussion. There's nothing to talk about.
So to be fair, there are some instances where a prenup could be critical and could be very important. But those are more the exceptions rather than the rules. So if perhaps people might move to a community property state where a court can invade separate property in order to equalize the parties, then maybe you need a prenup to protect separate property. The big reason, sort of the difficult issue, and I know you don't shy away from difficult issues, Beatty, is when one spouse has a business before the marriage. So say I'm about to get married and I have a business and it's worth $1 million. And then hopefully my marriage lasts a long time. And at the end of 10 or 15 or 20 years, my business is worth $20 million. Well, the increase in value between the $1 million it was worth the day I married and the $20 million it's worth on the day I get divorced is marital property. And or we call it appreciation of separate property assets that's due to the active efforts of a spouse is marital property. And so my spouse has a right to get that. So, for example, let's pick the simple case. If I have five partners, I want to make sure that I stay partners with my five partners. I don't ever want to be a partner with one of my partner's widows. And I certainly don't want to be a partner with one of my partner's ex-wives. So we might need a prenup. And here's where I diverge from the common understanding. So the simple way of drafting a prenup is to say, well, the separate property is all mine. My business doesn't count as marital property. I don't care how much work I put into it. I don't care if you come in and you help me in the business for 20 years. I don't care if that is our most important asset and we have just about everything we've worked on is dedicated to that business, you get nothing from that business. And that's problematic because then if we do that at the get-go, the spouse knows that the partnership is not a full partnership. It's like one big piece of the partnership is not there. And so I advocate that we find a better way. I mean, the problem is a real problem because A, we need to figure out how to value the increase in value. I gave you numbers before. If it goes from $1 million to $20 million, usually it's a lot harder to tell, and it's a very intrusive process when we bring in accountants and valuators to take a look at what's been going on, and they poke and they prod and they look at all the books and records. And so in my New York Law Journal article, I have a couple of suggestions of how we might be able to figure out a formula today about what we'll use to value it in 20 years. And so I advocate finding a better way, not telling a spouse you get nothing from it, but finding a formula to say, from that business, you will get a formula that's determined by, we'll take a look at, say, our audited financials, and you'll get a certain percentage of gross sales. And at least this way, the spouse knows that they're a partner in the running. And so that when my spouse doesn't come home, it's late at night or it's a weekend and they're working hard, I know that my spouse is working for the both of us and that my spouse isn't just working for him or herself. And that creates a stronger marriage.
I think what's really important too, what you're saying, is that there shouldn't be any issues at all that people are not able to discuss. To compromise, to have trade-offs, and to hopefully come up with a win-win resolution. And I think that a lot of people may not even be thinking about some of these things. You know, for example, let's say it's a second or third marriage, and you have children from your first or second marriage who are entitled to an inheritance. Now, if God forbid the marriage ends in divorce, you want to make sure that your children from your first or second marriage are going to, in fact, receive the inheritance and your unhappy third wife or third husband is not going to block what you wanted to have happen for your children.
Right. And particularly, okay, a divorce is less likely to do that because if I had it before I got married, that would be my separate property. And on a divorce, my spouse wouldn't have a claim to it. Where it becomes a really important issue is if I die. So many years ago, when people would die, say the head of a major Fortune 500 company would die, and the widow and children and orphans would show up for the will reading, and the lawyer would get up and say, I hereby give, grant, and bequeath all of my worldly possessions to my secretary, Candace. And everybody would turn around crestfallen. And so New York and many other states have what we call the right of election, where we make it impossible for a spouse to cut out their spouse from their will completely, and that the spouse has a right to get one-third of the estate. So if somebody dies without a will intestate, then the spouse, if there are children, then the spouse gets the first $50,000 and one half of the rest. But if they die with a will and the will says, I give everything to this charity and this child and that cousin and that uncle, and leaves nothing to the spouse can elect to take notwithstanding the will, and then the spouse gets one-third of the entire estate. So that means that if there's a possibility that I might die before my spouse, I need to leave my spouse at least one-third of the estate. Well, what if the business that I'm leaving to my children is worth more than 66% of my estate? What if it's worth 80% of my estate? Well, then my spouse can come in and take it away from them. And so if I want to make sure that my business goes to my heirs, to my children, without my spouse being able to collect that, then my spouse has to waive her right of election. And that's usually done in a prenup. So it's a waiver of the right of election to make sure that a spouse can't defeat an estate plan, which is critically important.
So people do need to be discussing all of these possibilities and contingencies that hopefully won't happen, but could happen. And I think that Absolutely. Talking about money and talking about business and talking about the division of property, if God forbid we divorce, I mean, these are really difficult issues to talk about. And yet in reading your amazing your amazing articles, what I discovered is that the prenups are actually gaining in popularity at a fivefold increase, despite the fact that almost two-thirds of those people surveyed believe that a prenup would weaken their relationship and likely increase their chances for divorce. And I guess that I wonder whether or not it is the prenup that would likely increase their chances for divorce rather than a lot of other things.
Well, they could be one or they're sort of the same. One may be an indicator of the other. So, as you know, I argue that there are, like Pandora's box, there are certain words that once uttered can never be locked up again. For example, if a man tells his woman, I don't find you sexually appealing, they can stay, quote-unquote, happily married for another 30 years, but that's always running around as she's always thinking about that. Her insecurities are gnawing away at her. She might try to suppress it, but she keeps thinking about it, and she keeps knowing. No matter how many times he apologizes, no matter how many times he says, I didn't mean it, honey, no matter how many trinkets or bracelets or necklaces he buys her, it will always stay there. It will always leave a mark on in her mind. Similarly, if a woman tells a man, you don't satisfy me in bed, and for the rest of his life, he's left wondering, was that real or was that contrived? Was she faking it? Was it real? And no matter how many times, he's never really sure. The same thing is true, if either spouse ever mentions the D word, the divorce word, they can move on. They can go through the paces of being happily married, but they're always there. They're always on a hair trigger where if somebody makes a move, they're like, okay, what's going on? Is this the time? Is he leaving me? Is she leaving me? And so some things are better off never said.
And, that's true.
And so you're absolutely right. I posit in this article, and again, I'm swimming upstream here, as I typically do, is that a prenup should rather be a marriage planning document instead of a divorce planning one. Instead of saying,
that's a great way of putting it. I love that, a marriage planning document. That just sounds, it sounds so positive versus let's get a prenup.
Right. So instead of what happens if it doesn't work out, what do I get, what's my consolation prize, mm-hmm. let's use this as a marriage planning document. Okay, how are we going to lead our lives? How are we, who was it who said there's this concept of a living will? What do I want to leave my children? I want to, not who gets which car and who gets which house, but what were the values? What do I hope my life stood for? And I hope my children take the love of family, the love of community, the community service, being a servant to the people, being somebody of serving the communal interest. The concepts, the motives that we really want to bequeath onto our heirs. Same thing here. If we use a prenup as a marriage planning document, what is it that we want our marriage to stand for? How are we going to lead our lives? What do we do if one spouse earns $100,000 and the other one earns $500,000? Well, do we stay at five-star hotels or do we stay at one-star hotels? Do we pay 50-50 everywhere we go, or do we pay proportional to what we're earning? Do we take all of our money and throw it into the marital pot and it belongs to the both of us? Or maybe each of us should keep 10 or 20%, whatever number's right for you, in a separate bank account. So if she wants to buy Louboutin shoes, if he wants to buy the boys a round of drinks in the bar, as long as it comes out of my share, my 10%, the other one has no right to pass judgment or give me grief over how I'm spending the money. But then again, we have to make sure that whatever we're putting into the marital pot is enough to support the family and to pay the communal expenses. We can't say, I've got my own little flush fund. If the community bills, if you don't mind my using that word, if the marital bills aren't getting paid. So we can talk about these issues. We can talk about our lifestyle, where we want to live, how many children we want to have, how we'll support them, what we plan for the future, and use that. And yes, if it doesn't work out, that might be part of it. But the document becomes a marriage planning document instead of a divorce planning one.
No, I think it's a wonderful, wonderful way to frame it. And I'm thinking, you know, I've been practicing now, Chaim, as you know, for over 35 years. And so many couples that I have seen prior to their getting married simply never talk about any of these business financial kinds of issues. You know, people are in love and they want to talk about the honeymoon and they want to talk about kids perhaps and lifestyle. But these are really important things. I mean, for example, you're a partner in a business. You have business partners, and God forbid if something happens, you need to protect your business. Your partners need to feel protected. So these kinds of conversations actually have to take place where there may be a great need for some real negotiation here.
Of course. So in the event of death, many businesses take out key man insurance for each of their partners. So if we have five partners, the business may pay for life insurance for each of us in the amount of, let's say, $1 million, with the proceeds payable to the business. So if one of us were to die, the business uses $1 million to buy out the widow's share. She gets $1 million, and we continue, and now the four of us own the business. The problem is that you can't buy an insurance policy. You could buy life insurance. You can't buy divorce insurance. So if somebody's about to get divorced, how do we buy out the spouse from their rights in the business? And so that becomes a harder nut to crack, and we need to sit down and understand the finances and the business, the financials of the business, and hopefully we can come up with a formula so that at the time, if there is a divorce, that the business can come up with a way of financing it so that it doesn't bankrupt the business and so that we buy out the divorced spouse.
Again, this is another subject that I would suspect and guess that most people, either they don't know that they need to talk about this, or they certainly don't talk about it, even if they realize that there are some loose threads that really do need to be at least discussed. I mean, how many couples, I mean, you deal with divorce. How many couples that you are dealing with who are going through the process of divorce have actually had these kinds of discussions at the beginning of their marriage so that when they're dissolving their relationships, that at least these loose ends have been taken care of, either by a prenup or some other arrangement?
Most don't. And in fact, the simple way of drafting a prenup is by doing what we spoke about earlier, saying, oh, the business is off the table. The business remains separate property no matter how much it increases in value. And and sort of the most people reconcile themselves, yes, it's unfair, but so what? This is the unfairness of it. And I've had colleagues debate with me saying you can't use fairness in these situations because it, inherently a prenup has to be unfair. And I'm suggesting that maybe it doesn't. Maybe we find a different way. Maybe we do it better. And the funny thing about it, and you sort of you're picking up on it, Petey, is that I've had people come to me, very successful professionals earning high figures of income. And they're like, oh, no, just give me a prenup. What do you mean I have to meet with you? Why do I have to meet with you? Yes, just pull it off the shelf. No, what do you mean I have to come in again? Why do I have to come in again? And
right.
It's funny, they viewed having a prenup drafted. Now, a prenup obviously is a document that's crafted for you, specifically for you and your spouse at this moment in time. And it's almost as if they think it's an off-the-shelf product, and they want to spend less time getting a prenup than they would selecting a pair of sneakers. I mean, today when you walk into to buy a pair of sneakers, they're like, okay, what are you going to use it for? Is this to play tennis? Is this to go running? Is this indoor or outdoor? Is it a clay court? Is it a cement court? And depending on what you want to use it for, you have to select the right sneaker. But this woman was like, no, just any. What do you mean it took 5 hours? I thought it would only take 3 hours. And it's like, wow.
Yeah. So are you saying, though, that even though we're talking about reasons that people should get prenups, you can call them marriage plans I love that term, a marriage plan, looking at all kinds of things in our lives, including our money. But do you really believe that if it's done properly, that it is going to put the relationship at risk and that there will be a higher propensity toward divorce than if people do not agree to have one?
So I start, perhaps this is naive of me and I'm arguing against my own self-interest. In general terms, where people are going to live in New York and they anticipate living their entire lives in New York and there are no extraordinary circumstances, perhaps it's better off you don't get a prenup. And so why bother? I had this woman call me. She was 22. Her fiancé was 26. And I'm like, what do you want a prenup for? And she says, well, he has $60,000 and I want him to feel protected on that $60,000. I'm like, don't worry about it. Don't. The crafting a prenup requires you to articulate certain things, and you'll be happier never having articulated those. Look, you and I know every marriage inevitably ends in either death or divorce. Yet how right. how many people draft wills? People are feel happier going through life not thinking about, oh, death, that'll never happen to me. That only happens to everybody else.
But that's a really good question. What percentage of people, you know, talking about prenups, but what percentage of people have wills? I would have thought that a very large percentage of people had wills.
Well, now with the pandemic going on, more people are scrambling now to write up their wills, and there's been a huge boom. And you may be aware of this. The governor signed an executive order that now allows notary publics to notarize documents, wills and others documents, when the person signs it over a video, a web conference. So if I see somebody signing a document and they show me identification and they affirm to me that they're in New York State, they can email me the document and I can notarize their signature. And that would never be, that would have been a misdemeanor a couple of months ago, and just for the duration of the pandemic. And so this is a hot issue because now all of a sudden people have realized their mortality. I'm suggesting that people are happier not thinking about things that we don't want to think about. And so for some reason, people think that a prenup is necessary. I'm saying it's not necessary. If you are in those categories where if this is a second marriage, if you need to protect others, I argue differently. Somebody told me recently, when we lawyers say the word argue, other people may not realize. I'm suggesting that it's a better position, that this is the better way. I was contacted. A man died, second marriage. The husband died. The wife was living in his house. And they finished the shiva. And as soon as they came back from the shiva, the children looked at their stepmom, and they looked at her and said, "So when are you moving out?" And she's like, "Moving out? What do you mean?" And they go, "Well, Pop left the house to us, and we plan on selling it. When are you moving out?" And she had barely realized that her husband is dead, and now she was being thrown out. So perhaps sometimes a prenup might be good to make provisions for our spouses so that people know, so that the prenup becomes a document of caring and love and devotion. Another great technique is if I am the moneyed spouse and I'm marrying a partner of lesser means, I might want to put money aside for them. I might say, "Honey, every year we stay married, I will put $1 million into a bank account in your name. And so if we get divorced after 20 years, you'll have $20 million. You won't get anything more, but you'll know you have $20 million in the bank. Or if we get divorced after 5 years, you've got $5 million in the bank." Now, that is a beautiful technique because every year that she accepts that money is another year that she has ratified the prenup. And she has indicated by her actions that the prenup is a valid prenup. So if at the time of divorce she wants to say, your honor, this agreement should be set aside," the judge would look at her, "Well, wait a second, you were perfectly happy with it for all these many years. You accepted the benefits of it. Now when it comes time to accept the limitations of it, you no longer want it." So that is a great technique, and the prenup then becomes an act of grace and benevolence. "Look what I want to do. I love you so much that I promise you for as long as we're married, I will put X dollars in an account in your name and your name alone. This will be your separate property, and you will not have to share it, and you don't use it for the family expenses. This is your money alone." Now, the caveat that I need to add to that is that if you put such a provision into the prenup, this is a great provision. It strengthens the prenups. It makes the prenup bulletproof. And I need to warn clients that if you put something in there like that, you need to make sure to live up to it. Because if you yourself ever violate that provision, instead of making the prenup bulletproof, that becomes grounds for setting the prenup aside. Well, you breached the prenup. You didn't put the money away as you promised. And so that could be grounds for the prenup to fail. So it's like a double or nothing type of provision. But if you do it, then the prenup becomes an act of generosity and kindness and approves your love. And it strengthens the relationship rather than weakening it.
So it's really, you know, as so many things, it's really in the approach. Darling, I yes. want to protect you and love you, and we have a number of different things that we have to talk about because of the businesses, etc. And this is going to be our loving life plan that we compile together. It's a very different way of approaching it. And I would suspect that most people, not only do they not talk about money and do they not talk about any of this, but when they do, it's probably done in a way that, as you correctly say, really weakens the bonds and really would inject fear, I think, into people about, oh my God, what happens if this doesn't work out and we end up in the divorce court? So again, it's the approach. Your approach is a loving approach. And I think that most couples would feel pretty comfortable. Maybe they wouldn't be able to do it alone. Would you say that there would be a need for somebody like yourself who had a loving, compassionate way about them that would help the couple look at it as a loving life plan for our upcoming marriage?
It's very hard for people to do this for themselves. There was an interesting study about women lawyers and their effectiveness. And it turns out that women, when they are advocating for other people, they are just as powerful as men advocates. But when women are advocating for themselves, somehow they're weaker and they don't present themselves with as much force and they don't come across as being as powerful advocates as they are when they're working for other people. And so, first of all, I've done this so many times before. I know what the issues are. I know where the landmines are. How many times has a client said to me, oh, you know, my spouse or my betrothed has asked for this and this and this, and that sounds fair. I think I should give it. And I have to say, well, wait a second. Let me give you a couple more considerations. Let me tell you how the law thinks about that issue. And once they hear it, they're like, oh, okay, so it's not that simple. So, A, you need to know the law and the reasoning behind the law. And then, B, you need to be able to advocate for yourself. And then, C, sometimes you need to be able to deliver a message. And if the person delivers a message themselves, I wrote a 20-page monograph on titles, So You Think You Don't Need a Lawyer. Part of this is uh-huh. as a lawyer, I can come in and I can be aggressive and I can challenge the judge. But if the client were to do that themselves, the judge would think, well, of course they should lose custody. They're unreasonable. Look at the way they behaved in court. So I can get away. And I often tell clients, you know what, blame it on me. Part of the reason that I get paid my fee is so that you can look at your ex, you can look at your spouse, and you can say, just convince Chaim. I have to do whatever Chaim says I should do. And so I become the bad guy, and it doesn't reflect badly on them. It doesn't inure to them.
Mm-hmm. So that if people are planning to actually have a prenup, what you're saying is that they need to find a good lawyer, a compassionate lawyer who is going to help them look at this document as a plan for our love and our marriage moving forward, rather than look at it as a dispute document.
And I would add to that, yes, of course, a good lawyer and, of course, a compassionate one and an empathetic one, but also a wise one, because these things are so fraught. And with one small gesture, you can either alienate somebody or you can bring somebody in. And,
right.
and so often, the nuance is so slight. And so you want somebody wise to be able to counsel you and show you how to navigate these issues. but also somebody who can bring the other side along. As I think I just heard that it may have been Robert Frost who said, diplomacy is the art of letting somebody else get your way.
No, that's very beautiful. Do you find with the people who you're representing who have made the decision to get a divorce that the issues are primarily money? I mean, why do you find that most people these days are filing for divorce?
I would start with they're just not in love. The you know that I speak a lot and think a lot about issues about love and true love and what it is, and I'm a fan of Harvey Hendrix and his works. Yeah. And so too many of us, we're so busy with life, we're so busy running around, we're so busy trying to make it that we lose sight. And when I ask people who've been married or have been together for 5 years or 25 years, and I say, what makes your spouse feel loved? And their mouths drop open and they go red and they're like, oh my God, I don't know. And so I advocate, find out, ask your spouse, what makes he or she feel loved? And
exactly.
Think about that for yourself. What makes me feel loved? So many people, after I ask them what makes your spouse feel loved, in order to placate them a little bit and show them what a difficult question it is, I say, okay, what makes you feel loved? And too often people can't even identify that, and they need to think about it for a while. So you know about the five languages of love. And some people want time, and some people want money, and some people want gifts. And some, and if you give somebody love in the wrong language, they don't get it. You and I think, have spoken about this. My favorite story of this man in a dark office building at 11 o'clock on a Friday night, working really, really hard because he wants to prove to his family how much he loves them. So he's trying to make a lot of money for them. And his wife is at home seething, because she can't go clubbing with all of her friends.
Exactly.
And you go, who's right? Who's wrong?
So well, I think
right,
that so much of this has to do, this has so much to do with people's ability to communicate. You know, this is what I need from you. And to hopefully have a partner who hears you and really wants to make the relationship work. And I think that, you know, these days we do, we prioritize everything, you know, bigger, better, more, travel, money, stocks, and the relationships suffer. I think in the beginning people are so committed to trying to have a good life, and you know, life happens and children arise and there are money worries and all kinds of other problems that surface. And before you know it, the couple oftentimes disappears. And sometimes it's too late. What I find is that most couples that I work with arrive just before they would contact you. And when people are committed, when they're willing to give it one last real try, and if there's something there, I think that there's a real good possibility that things can be turned around. But oftentimes it's simply too late. And I mean, when people come to see you, and I know you and I talked about it on the show the last time, you frequently will refer them to a marital therapist and see whether or not that one last try can really turn the marriage or turn the relationship around.
So perhaps I'm a bit of a purist, and so and I love this about the law, that we have our lines of loyalty and our duties run really clearly. My job is not to divorce people or get them back together or do this, that, or the other. My job is to effectuate the will of my client. So if a client says, I want to be divorced, I may talk to him or her about it and see if this is a spur of the moment thing or if this is a real decision, and maybe counsel them to slow down and give it some thought. But if my client tells me this is what I want, then my job is to get that done. and not to divert them or substitute their judgment for mine. Having said that, though, I will often ask clients, so tell me something. If you can I know that you're complaining about this and this and this. Aside from all of that, do you love them? Does this relationship have a chance? Or is it sometimes people are just so diametrically opposed? Here's sort of the trick, and I know you know this, and I know that you teach your clients and patients to do this, that we don't, and you started off by talking about the nastiness of divorce, and that's usually because we're angry at our spouses. Like, why can't he just be? Why can't she just be the person I wanted them to be? And if we recognize that people are who they are, and I can't change somebody else, I can barely change myself. And so
right.
If we have a square peg and round hole, if there's no way, no how, that person just doesn't value who I am. They're not bad. I can be a great guy, she could be a great gal, and we're not right for each other. And so you want to look at the deeper aspects of the relationship. Is there respect, or what has there ever been? Can I learn to respect? If I were to do, so to pick up on what we were talking about a few moments ago, I tell people, okay, if you know that your spouse wants to be remembered and cared for and feel like they're important to you, so maybe make sure every day, three times a day, when you walk out of the house, maybe text them, oh, I miss you already, honey. And maybe in the middle
That's
of the
right.
day, just drop them a text. And do the things that makes your spouse feel loved. And I hope that if you
yes,
do that.
Yes, those things, they make all the difference in the world. And yet you wonder how many people are doing this. We have a divorce rate of 73% for third marriages, 67% for second, and 48% for first marriages. So this is the whole thing, you know. Are people learning anything, or are we just changing partners and repeating the same kind of a dynamic?
And someone I know remarried his ex, and all my friends said, are you crazy? What are you doing? And he goes, for a second wife, she's good enough. The idea being that if we would accommodate in the first marriage, somebody called me up about how his wife is not letting him see his children because of the coronavirus thing. And I start talking him through it and giving him all of the considerations. And then I say something, I'm like, I'll tell you something, you probably won't like hearing it, and you'll realize if you did this during your marriage, you probably wouldn't have gotten divorced. But mm-hmm. sort of tolerate, mm-hmm. because you need to tolerate. If you couldn't change your spouse in the 10 years you were married, what makes you think that now that you're an ex and you're trying to co-parent your children, now you'll get them to change? And so,
no, it's true. And hopefully people who are divorcing, they are getting good advice so that they can at least divorce well and not destroy the children and not destroy the family, even though the day-to-day, you know, family relationships are forever changed. And that's something that I think is so important. I don't know how many divorce attorneys think about this. I don't know how many divorce attorneys care about this. I know that when I do mediation, you know, with couples where it's really all over, you know, I beg them, Chaim, to try and do what is in the best interest of the children, what is in the best interest of themselves. I mean, after all, at one time, people loved each other. They cared about each other. And even though the fabric of the marriage is over, there is still a way for people to move forward and do it well. And I'm sure you encourage that kind of behavior, you know, even though people are, you know, going through the divorce process with you.
Absolutely. And I approach it from the point of view of first, let's see, I get that you're really angry. And I had one client say, what do you mean she gets half of my business? She cheated on me. And now she's going to get one half of my business, and I have to sort of walk him through it and let him see the logic and the justice of it. And that somebody's fault in a marriage doesn't affect their rights to property accumulated during the marriage. And it was only at that point. So if we come to grips with this idea that I am who I am and you are who you are, maybe you don't respect who I am, and that's okay. God bless. I hope you find somebody that does float your boat. And I don't have to be angry with you to divorce you. I was speaking, you know, I do a lot of work on parental alienation when one parent turns their children against the other. And somebody suggests I speak to the group, and I offer to talk to them and give them advice, both on the legal aspects and the psychological aspects. I was talking about this. And somebody says, but what do you do? How should a father treat a child who's somewhat alienated and the kid is being a wise guy to this father? And I'm like, always, I'm quoting somebody else then, Dr. Dennis Turch, who's a good friend of mine. And he sort of taught me, it still bumbles around in my brain all the time. He's like, loving kindness. And he's like, but yes, what do you mean? Exactly. Sometimes you have to call the police. I said, yes, and do that with loving kindness. But sometimes you have to sue your ex. I'm like, yes, sue your ex with loving kindness. And this woman just became so exasperated with me.
Well, this is a wonderful way to be able to end this show, Chaim, with loving kindness.